the Mac Observer's Mac Geek App, episode 590 for Sunday, January 31st, 2016.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. Our goal is for all of us to learn at least two new things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include iMazing at iMazing.com, where coupon code MGG saves you 20%. We'll talk about iMazing shortly here. There's some cool stuff they got going on here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And how goes it today, Mr. John F. Braun?
It's all right.
All right, good. Hey, I'm gonna totally jump the agenda here because we got a bunch of quick tips to do, but first I want to play a question because that's important. So here we go.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Cyrus in Round Rock, Texas. Hey, I just want to point out some audio issues I've noticed on your podcast starting, I guess, late December, up through the first couple of podcasts in January. John's voice has this white noise sound sort of during and after when he speaks. So I don't know if it's a microphone issue or a transmission, a Skype issue, or however you guys communicate, but I thought you might want to know.
Thanks, Cyrus. Yeah, you know, the funny thing is we talked about this in pre-show last week and, you know, did some tuning and found we certainly were aware of the noise. And I was tuning it out with like parametric EQ, which lets you sort of narrow down on a band and slide around until you find it. And we sort of got rid of it, but it was sort of all over the place. And then I was recording an episode of my small business show podcast with Shannon Jean earlier this week. And I heard that from him, too. And I'm like, oh, man. What's going on? And I had been using different versions of Skype back and forth, and we use Audio Hijack Pro to record the show. And we'd been doing a lot of changing, and I'd been experimenting with some stuff. In fact, this show is being recorded in a way that I can't wait until I'm allowed to tell you about, because there's some very cool stuff going on software-wise today. John, you got your backup recording going, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. But any time in Audio Hijack, when you change your application input, it reverts to the defaults for that application. And the defaults for Skype are for it to capture both the incoming and outgoing audio. So capturing my audio as well as John's. The way we have it set up, I don't need that. And I don't want my audio on that channel. I just want John's audio on that channel, so we can kind of keep things separate and mix it the way we want to mix it. Skype also has this thing called comfort noise, where they found that people would think that the call ended when they were talking because they didn't hear any noise on the other end. And it's because we got used to this with telephones, right? You'd hear some sort of like line noise. And what was happening, I guess, is the because it was capturing both sides of it, the comfort noise was actually being generated from my side and then being sent out over the wire. And so it was capturing that. And so as soon as I realized it, I turned it off. And of course, I'm checking now to make sure that the Skype channel has comfort noise turned off. And it does, or not comfort noise. I don't think you can turn that off in that sense. But I'm only recording John. And so hopefully today we've got that problem licked. So that's where I wanted to start today. Sound good to you, John?
It always sounds good to me.
Well, right. That's actually...
But it didn't sound good to others.
No. But I'm not hearing as much of that kind of white noise buffer on either end. The reason you weren't hearing white noise the entire time, folks, is because we also use something... a noise gate is the simplest way to explain it, but it's really an expander, which is sort of a gate with a soft start and stop. And so you know, once John stopped talking, it would fall below the gate or the expander, and then you wouldn't hear it, the threshold. Anyway, on to some quick tips. So, but please do. I appreciate you doing that, Cyrus, and anybody else, as always. Keep us posted here, and we'll tell you what we're doing, because we're geeks, and that's how it goes. Kevin had a great tip. He said, here's something I stumbled upon, which I've not heard anyone mention previously. With any iOS device that has an A9 processor, which I believe limits us to only the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus at the moment. He says, you can dictate without an internet connection. The accuracy appears to be just as good or bad as anything before. Prior to the A9, an internet connection has always been necessary to dictate. I'm curious as to why Apple hasn't seen fit to mention this, at least not anywhere I've noticed. And Kevin's right. Siri doesn't work without an internet connection, but dictation does on the 6S and 6S Plus. And that's a handy thing to not have to rely on that connection to help with the dictation. Of course, I think the Samsung phones have had this for a while, but that's all right. You know, that's how it goes. It's pretty cool. Did you try this, John? You have a 6S, right?
Yes. Now I don't actually, I don't use the speech interface a lot.
I have found it really handy for like quick emails or Facebook posts or whatever. It's just so much easier to dictate than to try and tap it out with my thumbs. And then I can easily go back and edit and correct and all of that. But dictation makes life a lot easier in that sense. So it's good. You have to say it's good, period. I like this, comma, but, I don't like that. You got to talk that way. But you get used to it and it's totally fine. Period. Exclamation point. All right. Danny says, I don't think I'll teach you something here, but just in case, my life is full of joy since I learned how to reduce the time it takes to see the dock popping to existence when the cursor hit the edge of the screen. I want it as fast as possible. And he gives some terminal lines. We'll put a link to, I think actually Brian wrote an article about this. It's defaults right, com.apple.doc, and then there is an auto hide-time-modifier, and you set it to an integer of 0, and then you kill the doc, and you can set 0 to any number, and there you go. It just pops right up. There's no delay or anything like that. We like it. It's good stuff. Did you try that one, John? Or don't you do the...
I always have the dock visible with hundreds, you would shudder in fear at how many icons I have in my dock.
I have actually a ton of icons on my dock. I use the dock to I hide the dock on my laptop because I like the screen real estate, so that's where I hide things. And auto hide things, and it works out well. I don't know. It's good stuff. I like these little quick tips, folks. These are good things. Thank you. Actually, that one appeared on Mac Observer as well after we got the email. Jim writes, we have a music system downstairs and a separate system upstairs. Occasionally, I want to treat them as a single all house system with the same music playing in sync upstairs and down. If you try to set this up using the AirPlay icon showing on the top of your screen in the menu bar, you will find it's not possible. To make this work, use the AirPlay icon at the top bar of the iTunes window. Drove me crazy until I figured it out. And you're absolutely right, Jim. The AirPlay icon at the top will not do that granular level of multiple speakers and all that stuff. But the inside iTunes one is more flexible, and that's a good thing. Pretty good, right, John?
Awesome.
All right. Moving on to Chris. I got to find it here. Did we talk about Chris already? I feel like we did, but I don't think we did. On one of your recent episodes, Arena reminded me of the command tab to switch to applications with Q to quit. A standard many people, I think, are comfortable using. However, I stumbled upon this additional one a while ago, and I use it regularly. Switching between windows within the same application can be achieved with command and the button above tab, which is the back quote. I really feel like we did this one and I must just not have crossed it off, but there you go. It works. It's all good. Do you remember talking about this, John, or am I making it up?
No, though it's included in what's coming, so maybe that's...
Oh, okay. I for some reason, I remember reading this aloud, but maybe I read it to somebody else.
So. Yeah, that's how you're having vu jade or deja vu.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, command and the back tick, which is a backward single quote, will cycle through the windows of only the existing application, which is cool. Maybe I talked about it on TMO's Daily Observations. I've been doing a lot of podcasts lately. It's good. It's good. All right, John, you got an article that you're gonna talk about here with some quick tips.
Yeah, so I got it through like three levels of indirection here. So someone had posted, someone in my feed, I can't recall who, my apologies, but someone in my feed posted a link to an article, which actually linked to a Fox News article, which in turn was actually linking to this article. So, you know, they identified the source, which is good. You know, they didn't copy and paste it. They basically just put it under their banner and said, oh, and by the way, here's you know, where we got this. And that's what you're supposed to do. You know, always attribute your sources, right?
Sure.
It's just the ethical thing to do. But it's from a BGR Tech, which I haven't seen very often, but it looks like a dandy site.
Boy Genius Report. They've actually been around for a while.
Oh, yeah. That's what that stands
yeah,
for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. Because actually, I think the handle of one of the guys is Boy Genius. Okay.
Yeah,
yeah. But it is 25 hidden iPhone features that are really, truly hidden. And at first, I was skeptical, as we all should be. But when I looked through it, I'm like, you know what? I don't know about a lot of these. Or I knew about, you know, some of these and have talked about them. But this is a nice compilation. And we'll link to the article, but it tells you how to do a redial, how to clear your caches, making Touch ID work faster, spotlight conversion, spotlight math, deleting numbers in the calculator, which you just mentioned, right? Clearing RAM, burst mode, remote shutter, turning the flashlight off, and I won't read all of them. But quite a few of these I did not know about. So some tips for us all to share and make our life better.
Yeah, I'm just looking here. In the Notes app, all of the drawing tools are and the eraser are pressure sensitive. So 3D Touch actually works with those on the 6S's. I had no idea till just now. Huh. Very, very good. One of my favorites that I've sort of become re-enamored with, and it's listed here, is to clear your RAM to make your phone run faster. This can help with like when spotlight results don't appear right away and that sort of thing. You hold down the power button until it says slide to power off, and then let go of the power button, and then hold down the home button until you get back to the springboard, the home screen. And that's it. So you hold down one until things change, and then you let go of that, and then you hold down the other until things change. And then that clears things out, and it actually, I find it solves some of those problems. So it's good stuff. Awesome. Nice find, man. I like that one. It's good. You want to take us to Lauren, John?
I do want to take us to Lauren.
All right.
Because as you may recall in the last episode, we had a question about how to restore prior purchases that you've made in the App Store. And I had erroneously, though I won't totally blame myself, had assumed that because there was a little cloud next to some things in the App Store, that it was coming from iCloud. Well, it was coming from the cloud, not iCloud, but a cloud. I guess the App Store cloud, if you will. So then I decided to do penance here and actually find a source, an authoritative source of information on how you can do this for not only the App Store, but other stores. And thank you to our friends at Apple, because they have a support article titled Download Your Past Purchases. And it not only tells you how to do it for the App Store, but I think it tells you, I'll get it up. But it tells you for pretty much any store where you purchase content, if it's possible for you to download it or re-download it.
Any Apple.
They stay here.
Apple.
I'm sorry.
Run store. Obviously, because it's an Apple support article. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So here, the headline, and then, you know, we'll let you explore it if you like. But it will tell you how to find your past purchases in the iTunes store, the App Store, the iBook store, and the Mac App Store on your iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, Mac, PC, or Apple TV. So it covers all the stores for all the devices you may have from Apple. So, thanks, guys.
Yeah, good stuff. I love the.
I just kind of stumbled across it when I, you know, when we solved the last one. I just kind of, you know, fumbled around in the store and I was like, oh, look at that. There's, you know, a way for me to get an app that I don't have installed.
Yeah. And that's also not available for new purchases. That was the real trick. That was one of my favorite questions last week. One of my favorite questions of all time. And it happened last week because we both learned something from it. And hopefully all of our listeners learned something too. But I love that stuff. That's, you know, that is the goal. So it's good. All right. One last, it's not a quick tip as much as it is a tip from related to show 589, which is of course the last show that we did from Adam. He says, I was listening to the episode and I wanted to add to the remote support thread. If you need to observe someone else's iPhone or iPad screen and they have a Mac they can plug into via USB, you can have them plug in and then open QuickTime Player, start a new video recording, and change the input to the iOS device by using the small V-shaped pull-down next to the record button. That will display the iOS screen on their Mac screen, and then you can use TeamViewer or whatever your preferred method of remote controlling their Mac is to observe their iPhone screen in close to real time. You still can't control the iPhone screen from here, but you can definitely observe it and you know, instruct them through. So that's a brilliant remote support solution for iOS. It's probably the best I've heard of yet. So,
you know, and maybe I can extend it. So what was percolating in my mind, though I didn't mention it explicitly.
Sure.
I'm telling the truth here.
Yeah, but I believe
it. Here was my thought is if you could get, so the thing is you have to directly plug in. So you have to plug the iDevice into the Mac.
Correct.
Via USB in order for you to be able to view its contents in QuickTime. And I think technically this may be possible, but if you could somehow set up a virtual USB port to someone, and I know this is possible in some cases. For example, Dave,
see what you're saying, yeah.
The TP-Link that I have, and right now I don't think they fixed it, but the TP-Link router that I have also has a printer sharing feature. And the way that they do it is they actually install a kernel extension that sets up a virtual USB port to the device. So it's certainly possible. Well, unfortunately, what happened is that it wasn't signed. So this kernel extension that does that breaks under El Capitan and they haven't gotten around to fixing that.
Oh, sure. Yet. Yeah. Okay.
So I actually moved from doing that to sharing it from, I plug it into my Mac now and share it that way, make my Mac Mini act as a print server, which sure. is a perfectly valid way of doing it.
Of course.
Not as nice, I think, because the machine has to be on no, I think what happens is, yeah, if I'm invoking that and it's sleeping, I think it'll actually wake it up. It'll say, hey, you know, somebody wants to use the printer, dude. Whereas with the TP-Link, of course, it's always on. So, you know, that was a more convenient way to share.
Right.
Share a printer.
Right.
And
right.
a disk. That's another feature of it. Kind of like most Apple products.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or Apple routing products.
Right.
So, but yeah, if you could get a virtual USB driver and somehow virtually connect to the person's iDevice, that I think would be pretty spiffy. I'll have to poke around. You know, I bet you there's something out there you could cobble together that would let you do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, I guess it would just be USB over IP, I mean, is what that comes down to. Huh. Interesting stuff. I like it. All right. We've got a question actually from show 589. So while we're on the 589 bandwagon, we will go to Rob. He says in episode 589 from about the 1 hour, 5 minute mark, there were two listener questions that led to the discussion of moving backups from one drive to another, one involving Time Machine with James and the other involving a clone from Michael. There's another option that I thought worthwhile to mention. Apple's Disk Utility has a restore function. You can replicate the content of one drive to another. Select the source drive as the one that contains the current backup and select the destination as the drive you want to back up. You want the backup to end on. Click restore and leave it to run for however many hours it takes. As long as the destination drive has the correct partition type, GUID partition map, it will work. The destination drive will end up formatted correctly, with the same name as the source drive. I've used this many times for moving carbon copy cloner backups to a larger drive. It's great because it retains the backup history, including the archive and the safety net. And I've also used it for migrating a Time Machine backup to a larger drive. And Rob, you're absolutely right. This restore function, it's really simple. And because of that, really powerful. It's perfect for doing a basically 100% copy of the data in a partition without needing to maintain the size, right? A lot of times you can, you know, there, I guess maybe not so much today, but there were always these, you know, partition clone utilities, but you always had to have the same size, whereas Apple's restore thing doesn't. In fact, you can take your hard drive and clone it to a disk image and then restore it back from a disk image to another hard drive or even the same hard drive, and it works great. So, yeah, and it's not doing a, you know, bit by bit or sector by sector thing. It's doing just files, right? And so the benefit, part of the benefit is you, if you're using a spindle drive, you wind up defragmenting the drive sort of by default in the process because you're just recopying all this stuff onto there. Or at least that's been my experience with it. So yeah, the restore drive thing, I remember having a hard drive going south on me once and I used the restore drive thing. I got the machine to boot and it was like, all right, I'm not going to do anything else. I'm certainly not going to try and reboot it. The drive is up, but it's live. I need to copy it. This is how you do it. And you can clone a live, you can clone your boot drive, anything like this. So good stuff. Thank you, Rob.
I'm just scratching my head over this because you know how they kind of ruined disk utility and El Capitan. I'm just looking here to, it's not obvious to me where the part is to create the image. They certainly have in the images menu, scan image for, okay, maybe that's what, okay.
Well, you create a new image by highlighting your partition in disk utility and then go to the file menu and say new
image.
Image okay. From, yep, exactly.
Image from folder?
All right. You can do a disk image from the,
all right, it says blank image.
Well, no, not blank disk image. You'd highlight the disk and say, I want to do a disk image from that disk. And then you can do that.
Right. What I'm saying is that I don't know if I think they shuffled things around here as far as how you.
Oh, right. Because this machine is that I'm on is not it's not El Capitan. Let me pull up. Let me use remote access and wake up the iMac in my office while I vamp here. Oh, come on. You got to wake up. It's all good. Please. There we are. Okay. So if I wake up the iMac in the office and it's not happy because it's been asleep for a couple of days and it needs to think a little bit. And unfortunately, that means I have to vamp for a little bit. This is weird. All right. It doesn't usually take this long to screen share, but you're saying you don't see that option? You can't make a disk image from a drive anymore?
All right. Well, there's two parts here. So I'm looking on one machine here. And so there's the drive itself, and then there's, you know, underneath it, the partition.
Yeah.
And if I highlight it and then I go to file, I mean, there is a new image and it says, yeah, you know what? I think they screwed something up here. Because if I go to file, new image, I see blank image, dot, 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 image from folder, dot, 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 and then image from Macintosh SSD.
Yeah.
Here's the only problem. That's grayed out.
Probably because it's your boot disk. You can't create an image from the boot disk.
Okay. All right. So the option's still there. All
yeah.
Right.
But
from the file menu is where you create it. And then
if like you're doing it with an image. Yeah. But you can, the restore tab is different. You can drag the boot disk into the, you know, into the restore tab as the source. So, but you have to clone it to another disk. You can't clone the boot one to an image. At least that's what I'm seeing here on both El Capitan and Yosemite. So there you go. All right, John, we've got a, are we good on that one?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We've got a slew of questions to go through today, and I think we've got enough time to probably get through most of them. But first, I want to talk about our first sponsor. How's that sound to you, John?
Fantastic.
All right. Our first sponsor for today is iMazing at iMazing.com, where I'll tell you right now, coupon code MGG saves you 20%. So go check this out. iMazing is the tool that you want instead of iTunes to manage all the data that you have on your iPhone and other iOS devices. It can back up your phone. It can pull songs off of your phone. It can do all that stuff. But then once you have those backups, things get really, really interesting. You can dig in and actually change things inside of your iOS backups. For example, in the current version of iMazing, they now allow tinkerers to fully edit backups. Nothing is out of bounds. This enables what they call data injection of system data. For example, you can extract your text messages from one backup and inject them into another backup, and then you restore the modified backup to your phone. This allows transferring of only your text messages from one device to another without having to wipe the device at all. And that's the interesting part. You can restore backups from iMazing without wiping your phone to begin with. That means all the caches and everything else that you have on your phone remain intact. This is very, very cool stuff. iMazing 1.5 is actually coming out next week, and that includes even more backup editing potential. You can add or remove apps, including their state, to a backup, so you can restore selectively. This is very, very cool. Again, you don't have to wipe out your device before you restore, so you can restore selected stuff. Very flexible. You got to check out iMazing. Go to iMazing.com, download it. You can mess with it, play with it, do whatever you want. And then when you're ready to buy, coupon code MGG saves you 20%. Our thanks to iMazing for sponsoring this episode. And with that, John, it's time to talk to John. Because, you know, why not, right? John, listener John, has some questions for us here. And you'd think I'd have those in front of me. Why can't I find this?
I would think you would. I mean, it's right there in Evernote.
Is it right there? Oh, I see it now. Okay. I don't know. All right. Listener John writes, Dear Dave, hi to the other guys, but Dave, I know you do this, so I ask. I have four Apple TV third generation and a Synology DS1815 Plus NAS. I have Plex running on it. So for my single Apple TV 4G and my iPad, my fourth gen Apple TV and my iPads. I've read several articles that say Plex will run with Apple TV 3, but all start on a Mac with Plex as the driver, not on the NAS. What do I need to do to get it to run on my Plex server? What do I need to do? Asks strangely. Sorry. What do I need to do to get my Apple TV 3 to point to my Plex server on my Synology? Okay. Really, without more jumping through hoops than you want to do, Plex will not talk directly to your Apple TV 3. Yeah, there have been some ways to get it to, like, you know, doing some DNS spoofing and having it act as the trailers app and all of that. And if you want to go through that, it's fine. We'll find a link and we'll put it in the show notes. But by and large, Plex does not talk directly to the Apple TV 3. You can use your Mac or your iOS device, though, to play a Plex movie and then AirPlay it to your Apple TV 3. It's not ideal, but it works.
Okay, because normally you need a Plex client.
Client, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And Apple TV 3, of course, has no provision for installing software. So
correct.
You really can't, though, as you pointed out, people have cleverly engineered ways to trick it.
To trick it. Yeah. And it works. But here's the thing, you have a Synology, right? And Synology's own video station will play direct from the Synology to Apple TV 3 and to Apple TV 4 over its AirPlay connection. And we'll put a link in the show notes that sort of explains this process. The link I've got is a little overly explanative, but that's not a bad thing, right? It gets you there. One thing I will say, what you do is you, and here's the thing, the Apple TV 3 also doesn't have a client for pointing to the Synology. So you have to start the movie from somewhere else, and you can do it from your Mac in a web browser, or you can do it on your iOS device. But here's the difference. You're not pointing, you're not airplaying it from your iPhone. You're using your iPhone as the remote control to tell your Synology to airplay directly. And that's where this article is really helpful, because there is an icon that you click and say, play the movie over there. And you could even do this, like I could, you know, I could be in California and tell my Apple TV or my Synology at home to play to my Apple TV at home, and it would do that. Right, that's how this works, and it works really, really well. I'm not sure how they're doing it. I have some ideas. I think Erica Sadoun sort of re-engineered the whole AirPlay thing, and I think they're taking advantage of that, and they're fine with it. They, you know, they've been doing this for a long time. It works really well, because what you get to do is pull out your iPhone while you're sitting on the couch, use your iPhone, search around. It's really easy to search in the app. You find the movie you want, you say play it on the TV, and then you put your iPhone down. Your iPhone can even leave the house. It's no longer involved in the process. You can use your Apple TV's remote to play and pause and all of that stuff. We now have an Apple TV 4 in the living room, and so we have the Plex app on it. And on our, you know, our media server, which is a Synology, it points. Plex and our Synology libraries kind of point to the same place. It's one library, in fact. They just, the apps point to the same place, the server apps. So we can play the same movie from either place. We've used Plex. We occasionally still use Plex, but it's still easier to search with my iPhone and play them and find the movie that way and just kick it off from there. So even with the ability to launch the app on the Apple TV, you know, it's nice to have it all in one place, so you don't need your iPhone there. But how far away from you is your iPhone at any given point in time? This way is actually easier, and we really like it. So again, I'll put that link in the show notes, and there you go. So yeah, Alex in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream is asking, Dave, are you talking about pushing to the Apple TV 3 from an iPhone? And no, I'm not. I'm talking about using the iPhone as a remote control for the Synology, and the Synology pushes directly to the Apple TV 3. So just to restate that, hopefully that's clear. It's a little, I know it's convoluted, but yes, it does use AirPlay. It's pretty cool. In fact, I think I like it. It's good. What do you think, John?
I think you're right.
Am I? Okay, good. It works. The whole family likes it. It kind of passes the family test. Everybody, you know, is comfortable using it, and it works. It's really the best way to watch movies from a digital media library, I think. All right. Let's see if we can find, Mark in here. Mark writes, a few weeks ago, John helped me with an issue I was having with my MacBook Pro booting up into the utilities. After reinstalling the OS, that hasn't happened since. Today, when I turned on my MacBook, the hard drive spun, then it shut off. I plugged the power cord in and turned it on. The battery immediately showed that it had a 22% charge. Any guesses as to what may be happening? I'm leaning toward the power supply. It's a mid-2009 MacBook Pro. He says this isn't the first time it's happened.
I just want to clarify, because I don't think we covered his last issue. We ran out of time, which we typically do.
Sure.
Because we just have so much to talk about. But his machine, so it wasn't utilities that he was booting into, as far as I could tell, because he said, you know, I'm booting my machine and I see these four choices. He was somehow booting into recovery, which worried me, because as far as I know, unless you explicitly tell your machine, I believe it's holding down
Command R,
will boot you into recovery.
Maybe just R. I might have the command thing might be a holdover from my, I don't know, from some.
Or option R. It's one of those. But it's something with R. But as far as I know, unless you explicitly hold down certain keys, you don't boot into recovery. So his machine was booting in recovery. And he was like, do you think reinstalling the OS would help? And I'm like, couldn't hurt. So I don't know if there was some sort of damage that was detected and it booted into recovery. I personally have never seen a machine boot into recovery unless I told it to do so.
Yeah, I agree with you. It shouldn't automatically boot into recovery. And it is command in R, according to an Apple support article to which we'll link.
Yeah, and actually from the chat room, well, actually, this is one of my suspicions here. So Alex in our chat room, which you can find at macgeekgab.com/stream. Hi, guys. He says, in all seriousness, sticky keys. I'm like, well, you could have a bad keyboard. I mean, if...
both the command key and the R key sticking, though? I don't know. Well, I mean, it's possible.
I think that's highly unlikely, yes. No.
Yeah.
Or could it, you know, the cat, I don't know, or whatever, you know, critters you have around could have been walking on your keyboard as you started the machine up and happened to be holding those two down. I don't know.
There's weird things going on with this computer. I think it's safe to say. So
yes.
To answer this question, you know, Mark says he's leaning toward it being the power supply. The power, that's sort of a generic term, right? The power supply, technically speaking, is external to the Mac, right? I mean, there's this thing that takes power from the wall and transforms it into DC power that then it sends to your MagSafe connector, right? There is a power management chip, of course, inside the computer, and there's a mechanism for charging the battery and all of that. So there's power-related stuff sort of everywhere in the chain. Plugging in power seemed to solve this problem for you. So given everything that we know about this machine, really the first thing that I would suggest is trying an SMC reset, right? That, which is, you know, kind of the, if it sounds like hardware, but maybe isn't hardware, then reset the SMC and that might alleviate it. And we'll put a link in the show notes. It's different for every computer, but it's worth doing. It resets a lot of things, including the power management controller in the computer. So that alone could solve potentially all of your issues. Certainly this one. However, it's also possible that you have a bad cell in your battery and 20% is the lowest it'll go. We've seen this before. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen where the battery knows, okay, I've got, you know, and I'm just going to say for the sake of argument, 5 cells, right? And it just so happens that the last one in the chain has gone bad. Something's wrong with it. It won't put out any power, or won't put out much power, right? So you go to turn on your computer looks at the battery and says, yep, I've got, 20% charge. We're good to go, or a little less than 20%. Let's go. It spins up the hard drive. Suddenly the battery's not putting out enough, you know, juice consistently, and the computer says, yeah, we're going down, and that's it, right? And spinning up the hard drive is one of those things, right? It needs some extra juice, and that might be enough to say, well, we're not getting, you know, the power flow that we need. Down we go. Plugging in your charging pack, of course, says, yep, okay, great, let's go. And of course, it starts charging the battery during that process, and now you're at 22% by the time you get up and running. I've seen this happen before. So I've had it happen to me. So it could be an issue with your battery. The way to test it would be to let your battery run all the way down to zero and see if it still runs when it's below 20%. If it doesn't, then that would pretty much confirm that you've got that kind of a problem. Again, resetting the SMC, though, can alleviate that type of a problem, too. So that's definitely the first place to start. That's what I got on this one, John.
Yeah, because, I mean, you shouldn't have to... It sounds like what you're suggesting is a calibration operation.
No, I'm no. Suggesting a test. If the speculation is that the battery does not put out the right amount of power below the 20% mark for whatever reason, bad cells, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So let's let it, start it up, get it up and running, and then unplug it and let it run down and see, will it get to, does it run all the way down to 1% or 0%, or does it just shut off and die surprisingly sometime around the 20% mark? That's what I'm looking at.
Okay. All right. Because I had a battery that I actually did have to do what I would consider a calibration operation.
Yeah.
It was something in a goodie bag that I got. And the funny thing is, the first time I used it, it ran down like really quickly. So it has four LEDs on it that you would assume would, progress or degress
in
a linear manner, and they didn't the first time I used it. And then actually went the first time I charged it, it went from one light to three lights to four lights. And I'm like, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But no, I did a full charge and then a full rundown on it. And then apparently it fixed something. And I think it self-calibrated or whatever, because then it was fine. But out of the box, it was, or out of the goodie bag, it wasn't making sense.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah.
Yeah, the calibration thing I meant. I mentioned you, Apple claims you no longer need it. It's been a while since you had to do that with Apple batteries. Before, they would suggest that you run it all the way up and all the way down and all the way up.
Right.
I don't think they suggest that anymore. I mean, you could certainly do it.
But there's... I don't think
it hurts anything.
Yeah, other than adding cycle counts to your battery.
Right.
Yeah. But it doesn't help anything. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Joe actually has two good questions. He says, hi guys. I would seek suggestions from you on number one, small desktop speakers. Number two, an iPhone app for podcasts. All right. So for number one, my favorite, small desktop speakers. And this is the pair that's been holding court, at my desk down in my office for a number of years now, are the Audio Engine A2s. They are relatively small, but man, they sound so good. Now, you can't get the A2s anymore. These are self-powered speakers, right? So you plug you go from your headphone jack on your Mac out to the speakers, and then the speakers plug into power as well, and they power themselves. And they just sound so good. But you can't get the A2s anymore. You can, however, get the A2 Plus. And the difference between the A2 and the A2 Plus is that the A2 Plus adds a USB port on it, which means it has its own DAC, its own digital to analog converter. And that means that you're not using your Mac's somewhat noisier DAC. So you get this high quality DAC. You plug the speakers in USB to your Mac. You still power them because they've got amplifiers in them, and USB isn't enough to power those amplifiers. And you get even better sound. Pardon me. I guess this cold is still with me here, guys. That's my quick recommendation for speakers. I test a lot of stuff, and the A2s have maintained their spot at my desk for a while. Of course, in the studio, I've got A5s, and you can't get the A5s anymore. You have to get the A5 pluses and all of that stuff. But I don't think you can get the A5s. But the Audio Engine makes good speakers. So. And, you know, I'm picky about this stuff. So it's good. That's what I got on that, John. Use speakers at your desk, or do you just use your internal computer speakers?
On my desk, which is here, which is the Mac Mini, which is my podcasting machine, I use headphones exclusively.
Okay.
Over the ear, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm either on this machine, I'm either doing podcasting or gaming. Though I do have the A5s, yeah, as you pointed out correctly. Yeah, the A5s. I mean, so I have a pair of those downstairs, and then have a pair of speakers connected to my Apple TV, or actually my entertainment center are actually were somewhat inexpensive, and I guess you can no longer get them unless you're near a Radio Shack, but they were Radio Shack's house brand.
Oh yeah.
And they actually weren't bad. They were 100-watt speakers, because I blew up my prior set of speakers that, well, as I found out, couldn't handle 100 watts.
Sure.
All of a sudden they started sounding funny. I'm like, whoops. So and they were the I forget, it was their whatever Radio Shack house brand, and they're not bad.
Yeah.
Not great, you know. You'd probably you probably have an opinion about them.
I have an opinion about everything.
Well, even when you listen to the Heos that I have,
yeah,
you had some opinions about the projection. I guess their projection is not ideal.
Yeah, that's right.
I think you're just too tall. You're too tall for that speaker.
Yeah, well, that could be. It's true. I put my speakers up higher in the house here. And the A2s are interesting. You can get a little feet for them that angle them up so that they're aimed from your desk at your head. if you want to do that too, which is smart. I do want to point out, pardon me, I want to point out one thing. One of the differences between the Audio Engine 2, the A2s, and the A2 Plus is that it added the USB input. Going from the A5 to the A5 Plus did not add that input. So they are powered, or they are, their sound comes from an analog input source. So just so you know, they do, Audio Engine does now have the HD6 speakers, which have, their USB input, I believe. Right. Tech specs. Inputs. Bluetooth. Not USB. I thought it had a USB input. No, I guess not. I haven't checked that one out yet, so that I'm just learning about that. I actually listened to them at CES, but haven't played with them on my own. So they've got Bluetooth input on them, but not USB. So anyway, for small speakers, you're not going to go wrong with the A2 Pluses. I love them. As for podcast apps, of course, if you're going to listen to this show, the Mac Geek Gab app is free and allows you to do some very special things that are targeted at just this show. You can send feedback in and you can listen to the live stream from inside the app. You can leave bookmarks and all of this great stuff. So certainly for this show, it's worth having the Mac Geek Gab app. I highly encourage it. However, it's not the only podcast you listen to. So my favorite is Downcast. Works really, really well to manage everything to do with your podcasts. Does background downloads. You can have settings for individual shows. You can have global settings. It's my favorite, and I've checked out lots of them. And you know, I like a lot of the things that that Marco Arment did with his Overcast app. That's actually another great one. He wrote his own routine to speed up a show without making it sound too jittery. And it's actually, it works really, really well. But in terms of the UI, I just prefer Downcast for managing a lot of shows. So we'll put links to all those in the notes. What do you use for podcasts, John? You don't listen to podcasts, do you?
Rarely. When I do, I use what Apple offers that meets my needs. iTunes, pretty much. iTunes or, you know, whatever's on the iOS device. That's how I roll.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Apple's app isn't terrible. The podcast app. It's gotten better and better over the years, in fact. It's not bad. Yeah.
Yeah, iTunes, on the other hand, it could use some fixing.
Yeah, you know, I had this conversation somebody recently. I am not someone who believes that on the Mac iTunes should be chopped up into, you know, six different apps or whatever. I think it makes sense to have a single media player app on the Mac that manages all this. And I think it makes sense to have the store inside that app, because you're going to go and you're going to buy a movie or you're going to buy a song, and then you just want to play it right away. And you don't want to have to jump apps like you do on your phone. But your phone, this is my feeling on this. However, there is one thing that needs to be broken out of iTunes immediately, post haste, and that is syncing. You know, it syncing becomes this almost modal process where you can't do anything, you can't interact with iTunes in a meaningful way while you've got this sync happening. And if they broke that out and, you know, hey, call it iSync again, I don't care. I think that's what iTunes needs to fix.
Or I think what you're saying, or what I'm hearing, even though you said syncing, is the device management aspect.
That's a better way of putting it. I agree with that. Yeah.
Because right now, iTunes is, well, except for something like iMazing, but iTunes is the official way from Apple to interact with your iOS devices.
It's true.
Both for syncing and, you know, backups and some other operations.
Yeah,
that part.
No, you're right. And iMazing is the app that I use so that I'm not stuck doing this inside of iTunes. I do my backups there. It's, you know, it's just a much better experience for doing that, because It's purpose built for, like you said, device management. I love that term. It's much better than, you know, syncing, because there's more to do. And honestly, syncing may or may not be, it, you know, certainly isn't the biggest part of it anymore. You know, most of the syncing is happening over the cloud. So, yeah.
Well, backups, you know, backups and things like that, which. So, I'm leaning. I like the way you broke it out, though, is that you have the media aspect. Whether it be apps or, you know, I mean, the thing is kind of the app thing kind of bleeds over into the device management thing, or at least, and they've kind of changed that as of late, is that when you do a backup, you know, it brings the apps along with it. Though they've kind of changed the nature of that. So,
it's
just that they're kind of combining these three areas of functionality, and it gets... and especially when they change where things are, I think my biggest fist shake with iTunes is
that's Apple, you
know, especially,
right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And they don't do it with iTunes, but right. A lot of times it's like, okay, well, you know, what happened to the sidebar that I expected that, you know, showed me where everything is? They hid it.
Yeah. They decided that's not good for the future.
Yeah. And the solution was, oh, okay, well, you know, explicitly go to the menu and say, show the sidebar. And then everybody's like, oh, now it works the way I'm used to.
Yeah. Sort of, as long as you're somewhere where the sidebar appears, right? You know, I think some of this is, you know, the get off of my lawn factor, right? We are very used to, we grew up with iTunes and, you know, SoundJam being used in that way. And now it's kind of a different thing. Do people still maintain playlists? And I mean, is that an antiquated concept now that everything is just streamed and you just sort of go and you manage not your playlist, but your up next list, right? I mean, I still manage my playlists and I really like it. You know, I've been, when Apple Music first started, I had it added everything they had from Frank Zappa, including all the Mothers of Invention stuff, to a playlist. And then from that, I created a smart playlist that was everything that I had not yet listened to. And I marked everything as unlistened initially, and then I went through and listened to the entire Frank Zappa catalog. And I got to the end and I posted on Twitter. I'm like, oh, I made it through to the end. And people are like, wow, that's a massive undertaking. I thought, yeah, it took me a couple of months. And then, of course, somebody said, wait a minute, what's everything? And so I posted it and they're like, dude, that's not everything, you know? And I realized there was like more than double left. And of course, since then, Apple had added a whole bunch of other Zappa and Mother stuff to Apple Music. So I brought it down. And again, my unplayed thing served me perfectly well because it just filled it in. And so I like using playlists and smart playlists. I have my earphone test playlist that I use when I'm out testing headphones and speakers and I don't know, that kind of stuff. But I don't know if other people do it that way. The thing I just described is crazy, listening to every bit of music that Frank Zappa ever released. That'll change your brain, man. I think in a good way, though. You use playlists, John. I just don't know that everybody does. I like looking at my music that way. Anyway, where are we here? So we handled Joe. You want to take us to Ronald, John?
I think we will.
Awesome. I have to say, it's a little, you know, I've changed I changed kind of a lot, in fact, about the way we're recording the show. But one of the things I changed is there's a lot less noise coming from you. And there are moments where it's like, huh, I wonder, did I lose John? No, there you are. It's just nice and quiet and like it should be. It's good. I like it.
All right. So Ronald has a question, which I think is a good question because things have changed. And he writes, hey, John and Dave, my wife and I have been taking many photos since our baby was born. As expected, my wife's MacBook Pro eventually ran out of space, having a 256 gigabyte SSD. We use the Apple Photos app to manage and edit photos. I thought about transferring the photo library to an external USB drive and just plugging it in whenever we need to view or copy photos. But with a toddler running around, it doesn't seem feasible. All right. What's the toddler going to do? Oh, I guess run off with the drive. Okay. I don't know.
But yeah, you're moving the computer around a lot. I mean, you know, a laptop is meant to be portable, and having a drive tethered to it makes it less portable. In fact, when we're finished with this, I have a story to tell. I can't believe I forgot about my story. But anyway, okay. But I'm not going to interrupt.
So,
go. Much.
All right. To continue, I don't currently have a NAS, but I do have a spare Mac Mini in the house. I am thinking of using it as a server, but I'm not sure how to go about it with all of our photos. In particular, is it still a valid option to keep using the Photos app to manage our library? And I think it is. So the things have changed with Photos. So, but fortunately, there are some articles that will tell you what you need to do here. So when you start Photos, like many other Apple, I'll call them media management apps. See, I'm coming up with the clever wording today.
I like it.
Just, which I would include both photos and music and stuff like that. But if you hold down the option key when you're launching the app, typically you'll get a dialogue asking you to choose the library that you'd like to use. And Photos is no different. Here's the difference, though, with Photos. So Photos is a little different from other Apple products. And I actually found this out because I also run a transporter. For those of you that don't know, a transporter is a device that will synchronize content from your local hard drive to the transporter device, which is connected over a network. But it also shows you in the app, it'll show you files that it's syncing to the device. And I noticed that it was syncing JPEGs and all sorts of other things. And I'm like, what is it doing? You know, and I found out exactly what it's doing. It's reacting to the fact that Photos in the background is actually modifying the Photos library. Because it's doing some clever stuff. Well, you have the option with Photos to do some clever stuff. So you can certainly use Photos as a standalone app to manage your photos, but it also Photos ties you into Apple's various cloud services. And you can see this, of course, if you run Photos and you then go to you know, the preferences, you can see some options that you may or may not want to enable. So if you click on iCloud, you'll see iCloud Photo Library, which I'm not using personally, My Photo Stream, which I am using, and iCloud Photo Sharing. And as far as I can tell, if you have any of those enabled, then Photos is going to run this little background app that's going to be covertly updating the library, even when you're not running Photos.
And it can chew a lot of CPU power, too, especially if you're on an older Mac. It's just sort of a fact of life. But
right. So yeah. What you're going to want to do, though, because of the different nature of Photos, you're going to want to be sure so as far as I can tell, you can move the library to an external drive, but I'll tell you one thing you don't want to do. So the thing is, you probably, if you're going to move that library to another drive, you're also going to want to do something which Apple calls designating a system photo library in Photos. And they have an article that basically points you to the section of Photos where you do this. I suspect if you don't do this, then things will not work out well for you if you had any cloud services running, because then it's going to get confused as to where this should be happening. Another thing I'll point out is that, so there's another article, which I guess you may have pasted it already in the room there, Dave. It's called Getting Started with Photos for OS X. And they explicitly in this article say, do not use a cloud-based service to store your Photos library, because it will not end well for you. Again, I suspect because they're doing this clever background stuff, and sure, a lot of these cloud services typically don't deal with live or incremental updates to files very well.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, because you're going to be sending it in lots of directions simultaneously. Yeah.
So what I'm thinking here, so it seems like there is a provision for you to store it not on your local drive, but on a external drive, whether it be a NAS or a direct connected drive. The only thing I'm not sure of is how it's going to deal with the fact of when the drive is not there. If it's going to be smart enough to just put this synchronization, you know, cloud synchronization, if you choose it. If not, then I think you're okay. If you are using any of these cloud services, though, I haven't tried this, so my apologies, but I'm not sure how it's going to deal with the fact, how it's going to deal with the situation the drive is not there. Maybe it's just going to wait and hang out, and when it sees it come back again, then it'll say, oh, okay, whether you connect it via the NAS or a direct USB connection, it'll be smart enough to say, okay, now's the chance for me to synchronize.
Yeah, we do some of this here. I keep my photos library. I actually have a couple of them, right? And one of them is on the NAS, and that's actually the one that Lisa syncs with directly, right? So when she launches photos on her computer, it's opening up across the network, which actually works out great. It's faster on the NAS over gigabit Ethernet than it is direct on her, to her hard drive.
Using photos.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So it can deal with the fact that something is over NAS. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I was pretty sure, but I think we would have heard about it by now.
No, it works out great. The background stuff, if the NAS goes offline or her connection to the NAS is severed for any reason, the background stuff just doesn't happen at that point. However, if she launches photos while that connection is severed, it will default to either opening, if it exists, or creating a photos library in the default place, which is home pictures, photos library. So you've just got to be aware of that. But the chances, especially in our scenario and possibly even in Ronald's too, is if your internet connection is live and you're connected to the internet, you're probably also connected to your NAS on your local network. Of course, with a portable computer, you wind up taking it in different places. And this is where you might actually intentionally want to have two different photos libraries going simultaneously, one on your NAS that becomes sort of your offloading place, right? So you've got your MacBook that you can take with you. It doesn't matter if you're home or not. And that's your sort of place where you triage photos, you put them there. And then occasionally when you get home or while you're at home, you offload photos to this library on the NAS. Now, that's not an easy process with Apple's tools, but there is a tool from Fat Cat Software called Power Photos. You might remember Fat Cat Software is the people who made iPhoto Library Manager, or IPLM, as we called it for years here. And Power Photos is that tool for photos instead of iPhoto. So you can copy photos between libraries. You can actually merge two photo libraries if you've got things, or photos libraries, I should say, if you've got things all over the place. It'll find duplicate photos amongst libraries, and you can, it's got all kinds of great stuff going on there. So definitely worth checking out if you're in this scenario. And it's one of those things that when I moved to photos, it was like, oh, wait a minute, iPhoto Library Manager doesn't exist anymore. This is bad. And thankfully, Brian over at Fat Cat was like, yeah, don't worry. Power Photos. Here it is. So it's good.
And that's the one thing that makes me sad about the newer portables that don't make it easy for you to expand your hard drive, is when you run into a case like this where you would like to have them on your machine, but you can't because you didn't get a drive that was large enough because you didn't anticipate that you would need that much space.
Well, the other option is to pay, Apple says don't use cloud storage, but Apple has a cloud solution that will address all of these problems. And that's, iCloud Photo Library, right? So if you use iCloud Photo Library, you would need enough storage there. So you would need to buy storage from Apple, most likely, to fit all of your photos, but it will then intelligently manage what you have on your Mac based on the storage space that you have on your Mac. So it won't necessarily keep full copies. It might just keep thumbnails of all of your photos on your Mac. And then you can, when you want to see it, it pulls it down from the cloud and manages it dynamically. It's certainly the simplest solution here. It may or may not, again, the quote unquote best is sort of a personal choice, but makes it easy. And then you can have, two computers logged in, and your wife could have an account on the Mac Mini that also logs into her iCloud photo library. And you could have that one set to, you know, if it's got enough storage, pull down all the copies, all, you know, full size copies of all the photos onto that one. And then you're good to go. Yeah, you're using some of your internet bandwidth to do it. I doubt that Apple's efficient enough to pass things between two computers. Heaven forbid. But you know, that would be the other solution here. So there you go. That's my thoughts on it. It's good stuff, though.
Yeah, I think that about covers it.
Sweet. So, John, I said I had a tale to tell. You guys know we talked about the TiVo Bolt, right? And I liked it. And this was one of those reviews that I knew was going to cost me some money, and it was true. So I bought a new TiVo Bolt. They wouldn't sell me the review unit for whatever reason. It's just, you know, paperwork. I don't know. But that meant, but it meant having to move all of my shows again, right? Because when I set up the Bolt for review, I moved all the shows from my Premiere to the Bolt so that we could really just like use it and review it properly. And that process is fine. It'll do it over the network, but you have to go to each episode that you want to move over and say, transfer this episode. It's like a real pain. Now, to be fair, you don't even have to move them over. If you've got both live on the network, you can just watch over the network from one TiVo to the other. And that's sort of the whole new TiVo paradigm anyway. So we could have done that, but I wanted to just get them all over there, and that's fine. And certainly now, with this, you know, loaner unit having to go back, I don't want to keep it forever. I don't want to keep it longer than I need to. They want it back. They've got other people that want to review it. And so I want to get my stuff off of it. And I was like, oh man, now I got to go back through and like click every episode. I thought, you know, there's gotta be an easier way. And there is. So I used two pieces of software and my laptop to do this. I plugged everything in to the same Ethernet switch. So I was getting gigabit Ethernet between my laptop and my two TiVo Bolts, right? And just for reference, if you've got two TiVos set up, cover the IR port on one of them. And in the Bolt, it's in the black TiVo logo. So we just, you know, put something over that and that was fine. So now we're not controlling two TiVos. But over the network, you can download the shows. And then you can also tell a TiVo to request shows, so push a show to a TiVo. There's two pieces of software to do that. The one that will let you download shows from the TiVo, and there's actually several that will do this, but the one I used was called KMTTG. And the reason I use this is because it's very easy to automate. It's a Java software, so I had to update Java on my Mac. And people get all wavy-armed about Java. Java is awesome. There are some security concerns when running Java inside a browser, but this is just running an app, so it's all good. And then it will link with another piece of TiVo management software for the Mac called PyTiVo, P-Y-T-I-V-O. And again, this is Python TiVo, and it's also cross-platform and runs great. PyTiVo can do several things. One of them is it can tell a TiVo, it can push something to a TiVo, which, as I said, is really telling the TiVo to request it from it. There's a whole thing, but it essentially becomes a push. So what I was able to do is I went in KMTTG, I selected all the shows from the loaner TiVo, and I said, download these, but don't convert them. Just leave them in the TiVo encrypted format and then push them to the new living room TiVo. And I selected everything all at once and I hit go and it started downloading. Now I had to connect a big monster hard drive to my laptop to store all these things, because my laptop drive wouldn't have had enough space because it was about 500 gigs worth of data. And it took, you know, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, and then everything was done and everything was migrated over. And it was, you know, a one click operation once I got it all set up. Now, in the end, would it have been faster for me to go through and queue up each one as opposed to setting up this whole environment? Maybe, but probably not. In fact, it was a pretty painless setup. So I just wanted to share that that little story. There's the tools out there if you look, and we'll put links, of course, to all of these things in the show notes, just so you know. Have you ever used either of those things, John?
No, there's different tools for me because I'm still old school on the Series 3.
PyTiVo, these two things will work with the Series 3.
Yeah. Oh no, I use those tools.
Okay.
Yeah, I use PyTiVo. Yeah, the tools that you mentioned, but for cloning things from one drive to another, the tools that we use are different because last I checked, the format of the drive in the Series 3 is somewhat proprietary. I think they use something called MFS, Multimedia File System or something.
Yeah. Whereas well, that's why I did this over the network. And that way there's no concern with the format. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yeah.
Fun.
So did you get the Lifetime? Were you able to get Lifetime for your Bolt?
I did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you got to pay quite a bit sometimes, though they may cut you a deal.
TiVo cut me a deal. Yeah, they did.
Well, I know a lot of people. Yeah. Especially if you're like, gee, you know, I'd really like to use the TiVo moving forward, but I'd really like Lifetime too.
Yeah. Well, I paid full Lifetime price for my Bolt. I didn't get a deal on that.
Oh,
but
okay.
But the PR department helped me with the Lifetime thing, which was actually very nice of them. I didn't expect it out of them. I just asked them, can I buy the one that I have so I don't have to go through this headache that I went through yesterday? And they're like, no, but here's what we can do for you. I'm like,
my understanding is they'd rather keep you happy as a TiVo customer moving forward than having you abandon them.
It's true. You don't need to be a reviewer to get a deal out of TiVo from what I have been told. It's true. In fact, we wound up getting Lifetime on all of our other TiVos from their support department. We reported a bug to them and they were really thankful for that. And they're like, we really would like to do something for you. And they had no idea. I mean, through the process, they'd learned who I was. But at the time they were, you know, they didn't know it was a real problem. It was when the iPad app first came out. It was if you tried to use that to migrate season passes between your old TiVo and your new TiVo, which you can do now and it works totally great and you can do it online and it's awesome. Things were getting deleted. Like season passes were getting deleted from both places and it was really, really bad. And I reported it to them. They're like, they were thankful and they said, hey, can we, you know, bump your TiVos up to Lifetime? And I said, well, one of them already is, but these other two, yeah. And they're like, all right, cool. Make your next payment of your whatever thing and that'll automatically trigger you into Lifetime. I was like, that's nice. Yeah.
Because I can understand, you know, a lot of other people are following this model, you know, like the cell phone companies as well.
Yeah.
Rather than getting a big lump of cash up front, they really would much rather have recurring revenue.
Yes.
You know, which is one of their models is that you pay monthly or yearly for a subscription to get the program data, which you kind of need to use the device in any reasonable fashion. You can still use it without
a
subscription, but it's rather unpleasant, I would say.
That's right.
You got to manually program everything.
All right, we've got a few more minutes left, John. You want to take us to Terry?
Terry has a good one. So, hey guys, my SSD is getting over full on my 2012 Retina MacBook Pro. Yeah, see that's my fish shake because that's I think one of the first models where it's not easy to replace the SSD.
Right.
So he says, Drive Genius found a lot that I felt safe wiping out, but I'm not certain of these. I think I've heard you mention these before, maybe a year or so ago, but don't recall. The folder is Macintosh HD /lost+found or lost and found. But it uses a plus sign, not an and sign.
Right.
And the two files are inode 84849945. Which is 5.1 gigabytes in size. And inode 112, inode 112580407, which is 6.08 gigabytes.
Those are big files.
That first inode file, the second one, no. Those are pretty much arbitrary numbers that it comes up with here. But here's what's happening. So this is a result of OS X being Unix-based. And when a Unix-based systems have a problem with files. Typically, if a file operation is in progress and then something bad happens, like the machine crashes or whatever, rather than just ditch what's happening, most Unixes, right?
I like it. I mean,
we'll take whatever they find. We'll take, you know, these kind of things that were in progress. And they're like, you know what? I'm going to put this in this folder called Lost and Found. And then you figure out what to do with them. And that's exactly what happened here.
Yeah.
So I don't know what caused it. Now, whether you want to get rid of them or not, can he safely get rid of them? And the answer is yes and no.
Well, the OS isn't using them anymore, right? Correct. I mean, yes. You know, by nature of them kind of been having found and then placed over here, nothing knows they are there in terms of active processes. But it's possible one of these things could have been a file that was really right. important to you.
Yeah, so that's why I answered it in kind of a obscure fashion.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
Now, the thing is, it's the name of the file is inode. What is that? Well, that's the name that it gave it once it found that there was, you know, this problem with the file system. Here's how you find out what type of file it is, which I think will lead you on the path to determining whether it's something that you need or not. And what you can do is you can go into our PAL, the terminal. Do not be afraid. Change over to the lost and found directory. And then if you type file space and then the inode file, which you can probably, you know, hold down a key and then hit tab and it'll do auto completion. It'll tell you what type of file it is. Isn't that slick?
Seriously?
Try it, man.
This is new for me. I like this. See, this is why we do this show. Oh, really?
So file is a command built into at least OS X, and it may be a just general Unix thing.
Yeah.
But if you type the word file and then a space and then give it a file, it'll do its best. And I think it does it through a combination of I think there's a database of, you know, headers and patterns and stuff like that is also baked into this command.
No,
and it'll do its
way.
Best to tell you what type of file it is. Like, I had this problem actually one day, and it told me, yeah, this is a .pkg, which in some cases is actually an installer. And actually, I would suspect that's in most cases where I've heard of these inode files, they're actually old OS X installers. And actually, looking at the size, I would say that
that's possible.
Be.
Yeah, dude, I just did it. So this isn't going to come as a surprise. I've got a bunch of MP3 files on the desktop of the computer here in the studio, and so I did file on one of them. But, you know, it has the extension .mp3. And of course, it told me immediately, this is audio file with ID3 version 2.3.0 contains yada. And it's like perfectly. It's a layer 3 version, 128 kbps, 44.1 kilohertz joint stereo. Like, wow. OK, but it had the .mp3. So it had a hint of getting there. So I copied the file to just a, you know, test with no extension, nothing. And I did the same command on this test. And it told me exactly the same thing. It knew. So it looks at the headers and digs in, like you said, as best it can. That's, dude.
So what you could do, and also in the terminal, so I would say probably the easiest way, so I don't think in the terminal there's a rename command, but there's a move command, right? Or is there a rename
move is how you rename. MV, actually, is how you rename.
So what you could do is, once you've identified the type of file, is you could rename it.
Oh, sure.
With the proper extension, because even if you identify it, like in your case, even if you identify it as an MP3, if it doesn't have the extension, some programs. So what I'm saying is that once you rename it, then assuming it's something that you want to continue to use, then the programs that are used to dealing with it will be able to deal with it. Whereas if you just try to, so say, for example, it's a graphics file. Some programs may not be smart enough to process it. They may not be able to do this identification. So if you try to open an inode file that is actually a JPEG or a PNG or something in a graphics program, maybe it'd be like, huh? Though I think most would be smart enough, but I'm just. If you want to recover it, so first you look at it. So first you rename it, and then it may still be a mystery. So even though it's like a package file or an installer, you may still have to run it.
Right.
In order to figure out what the heck it is. If it's a, you know, like you said, you know, if it's a MP3 or something like that, then, well, you listen to it and tell if it's you're probably never going to recover the name of the original name of the file, but this will lead you to the path.
I don't know. The MP3, if it's got ID3 tags in it, might have a name.
Good point.
Right. I mean, it depends on the type of file, of course, but the name. Yeah. You won't recover the original actual name of the file, but you might recover enough of something that gives you a hint as to what might be another good name for it. Yeah. See, folks, this is why you listen through all the way to the end, because sometimes that's where the golden nugget is. Actually, there've been a lot of golden nuggets in the show, but, man,
how about a golden ticket? I want a golden ticket.
Yeah, I like it. Ah, man, that's good stuff. Sweet. Well, and, you know, sadly, it is the end. I do want to point out one thing, though. When you started that, you said that the Retina MacBook Pros were the first models, or one of the first models, where replacing the SSD was not easy. It's not terrible, and I'll put a link in the notes to, you know, the Envoy Pros from OWC. And in fact, there's a Mac Observer logo from one of our reviews right on the page there.
But now, Dave, you know what's interesting, though, is that the machine that I have, I would consider one of the last easily user upgradable machines.
Yeah.
And that's the MacBook Pro 2012 15-inch. And actually, I saw an article somewhere saying that a lot of people still like this machine because, you know, it's not a wimp. I mean, it's still fairly powerful. But I actually determined something. So you were talking about IR remotes the other day.
Yeah.
This is the last MacBook Pro to have an IR receiver.
Oh, yeah.
The Retina. Because I actually looked through Mac Tracker, and the Retina is the first machine, or at least according to Mac Tracker, that does not have an IR receiver. And I think every MacBook moving forward from the 2012 does not have an IR receiver in it. Which, because I found an IR remote, and I was, you know, trying to control my Mac, and it wasn't working. It was making the lights on my Apple TV flash, but it wasn't activating it because it wasn't paired. You can, you know, marry an IR remote to a device.
Right.
Huh. But yeah, not that it's a big deal. I think a lot of people don't really use the IR remote on their Mac anyways.
No, but when I got my 2011 MacBook Air, it did not come with a remote. And I was like, oh, well, awesome. You know, I'll just I'll get an Apple remote. And so I ordered one. And I was like, how come this thing doesn't work with this? Like, oh, yeah, this laptop doesn't have an IR port, but that's OK.
But you said 2011?
Man, my 2011 MacBook Air does not have an IR port.
Yeah, I think the Air series.
Yeah.
None of the any of the Airs.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I just, you know, I was being stupid about it. Anyway. All right, folks. Well, feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the address to which you will send your notes, your comments, your thoughts, your cool stuff found. That's been working well, alternating each week between quick tips and cool stuff found. I like it. It's a nice little pace. It's a nice little break. I feel like we can find a third thing in there and rotate them out, but, you know, we're not in any rush. It'll happen organically. In its own little way, like things do here. But send it all in. We'd love to to hear from you.
But if you are in a rush, you want to write to feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
No, you said feedback at MacGeekGab.com. Or premium at MacGeekGab.com. If you are a premium member, please take a minute, visit MacGeekGab.com, learn what our premium membership is about. If it's something that you're interested in participating in, you do get the benefit of us prioritizing the notes that you send in. Plus, you get that warm, fuzzy feeling of supporting your two favorite geeks directly. We certainly appreciate it. It is a huge part. The premium memberships are a huge part of what keeps us going here, and we really do appreciate it. So thank you to all of you that are a part of it. And if you can't be a part of it or don't want to be, that's okay, too. I just don't want you to not know about it. That's it. It's an awareness thing. That's all. 206-666-GEEK is the number that anybody can call and leave us a message. And John, Geek is
4-3-3-5.
That's right. Find us on Facebook. MacGeekGab.com/Facebook is the best way to get to our Facebook group. There's some great people in there. A lot of them actually are in the chat room today with us. Thank you to everybody who participates in that group and helps out. We get a lot of new folks in there every week. Some of you are coming in with answers to questions. Some of you are coming in with questions. Everybody's taking care of each other. It really is the epitome of what we do here, because everybody, it's just a community, and we all like to help each other. We share cool stuff. We help each other with their questions. And I, when I say we, I mean, you are more a part of that we even than John or I are. You guys answer these questions before I even get a chance to see them, and it's great. So thank you to everyone who participates there. Also, a great big thanks to Cashfly, CacheFly.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get this show from us to you, and, of course, our podcast marketplace. We have some great sponsors, as we mentioned during the show. iMazing. Coupon code MGG saves you 20% off of this awesome device, iOS device management application. It really is outstanding, so you got to check it out. Gazelle at gazelle.com to sell off your old iOS devices. Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek is the place where you can go to see what they've got for you. Of course, Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG with coupon code MGG saves you 10%. OWC, I mentioned them in the show. They're a great sponsor as well, MacSales.com. Barebones Software at barebones.com. BB Edit 11.5 is out. We'll talk more about that very shortly in the show here. And then, of course, Casper at casper.com. With coupon code MGG saves you $50 in free shipping. John, do you have any advice to share?
I think I do. I don't know. I was trying to think of something clever, but barring anything clever, like don't take wooden nickels, though they haven't made those in ages, then I would say the only other piece of advice that we have for you is don't get caught. We gotcha.